The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower and Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is David Greetham. David is the Vice President of eDiscovery Sales and Operations for RICO. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you. We were both at the at the 9:30 Gov conference last week, and I did sit in on your presentation. We're going to touch on that later on, but the overarching theme for today is digital forensics, and fortunately, I'm here with a pioneer of digital forensics. So, David, give us a little background on you, and then fill in the blanks on how this whole thing got started.
Well, you probably tell from my accent, I'm not from these shores. I was in at the start of computer forensics in the late 80s in the UK, when really the PC market became a realistic thing as IBM created PS2s and other people emulated them, and people had PCs in their home. And with that, of course, comes some great things and some people using them for bad purposes. And we found that people that were robbing banks were no longer drilling through the vault in the building next door. They were actually accessing them electronically. And that was really the start of computer forensics. It really was a response by law enforcement to deal with this dilemma.
Okay, so we have the obvious part there, but the academic side, the practical side of eDiscovery, digital forensics, give us some meat there. I mean, what was your role in this?
So really, you mentioned being pioneers. I think we were all pioneers at the time. It was very new. Some of the things, you know, when you use a computer system, a lot of the actions, in fact, most of the actions that you do are recorded in the system, not by any eavesdropping system, but by design to make the systems function better. So a good example would be in 1995, Microsoft brought out Windows 95 and they said this is the fastest way to use the internet, because at the time it was sluggish and slow and not really practical to use. So how Microsoft dealt with that was that they downloaded every web page that you went to, so that next time you went there, it could load the local downloaded copy and just to update in the background any changes. From a forensic aspect, that's, you know, great, because you can find out what websites people went to. And to add to that, as we have adopted in the late 90s to now the use of search engines, that would include the search terms that people have used. And that's really significant because it can show intent if you were looking at something, perhaps illicit images or somebody downloading something on how to do something. It can show intent, and those search terms are recorded along with those web pages that are downloaded. So really, these are all in hidden system areas, and that's just one example. But this kind of thing is what forensic experts will analyze and produce scientific results based on.
Okay, so if you're sitting at your computer, you have a specific IP address. So pretty much anything you've done there can be digitally recreated.
And if recreated is a great word, it can certainly be shown and demonstrated. And while there are some synergies with IT skills, this is a science and it's done scientifically. So it's proven as a fact, not as an assumption or finding. If you just talk about Microsoft and the Windows operating systems by example, what can be recovered from those systems in the use of a computer can get extremely granular, from nanosecond to nanosecond, the activities of a computer. And that can be used on occasion to put somebody at the keyboard. Now, that's a challenge in forensics if you have a computer that's used by multiple people. So you can look at surrounding data. If somebody went to their Facebook, 3 seconds before they did something else, you can draw a conclusion that that was the same person at the keyboard, because some they couldn't have come away from the keyboard and somebody have gone back to the keyboard different within 3 seconds.
Okay. So does that provide like a time and date stamp?
Yes, it does. And you know, it's not a time and date stamp from the computer itself. It's typically a time and date stamp from other sources. Like when you go on the internet, by example, and everybody's connected these days, there are servers that have time and date stamps that not be able to be manipulated in the way that you could change the time on your computer.
Okay. So I mentioned 930Gov. A year or so back, I spoke at the 930Gov conference, and I met some of the RICO folks there. And what surprised, it didn't surprise me that RICO was involved in records management, but it did surprise me for a variety of reasons that RICO was heavily involved in digital forensics, particularly in e-discovery. And one of the reasons is the e-discovery thing seems to be all over the news these days,
right.
You know, overtly or covertly.
Yeah, it's interesting. RICO has been around for more than 80 years and have really dealt with information traditionally from a hardware side and multifunction machines and what have you. In the last 10, 12, 15 years, RICO certainly transformed into information management and managing information, or we tend to call that information governance these days, or governance, risk, and compliance. And e-discovery is a significant part of that.
Okay. So when did you come aboard RICO and start assembling this division?
So I joined RICO in 2012 as they acquired my consulting company. And they'd started building this division many years before that. And I just came along and helped to drive it forward with new offerings and really planning for the future.
Okay, so what's your plan of attack at this point for that division? I mean, obviously, you guys were at the 930Gov, so you're targeting government, but you seem to be heavy into legal and corporate environments as well.
Yeah, I think it would be fair to say that as the industry is changing, and as we have so much more data as a group of people. One of the things we talked about at 930Gov last week was how much data we create just by going through our daily lives. I think now it's more not just about e-discovery. E-discovery is part of a bigger challenge, and that's the information governance and data management. And that's records management. It's how do you respond to a litigation, or how do you ask, if you're a government entity, how do you do a document request from somebody that they can comply with? And really, from a corporation's point of view, they have the challenges of how do we manage all this data? So that certainly does involve litigation. It does involve government requests, but it also involves how do they maintain their retention policies? How do they make sure that they don't have social security numbers stored that are not encrypted and things like that? It's now bigger than e-discovery. E-discovery is certainly a part of it. But information management and enabling people to understand what information they have to make valid business decisions based on their findings is really where we're driving.
Okay. Well, let's back up for 1 second here and give me a broad definition for digital forensics. So let's create a shell.
Right. So digital forensics is very much post-mortem. It's after the event. Some people confuse it with incident response, and that's really
point of attack.
The point of attack, or it can be point of attack, and it can be preventative. Forensics is after the event. I think there's some nice Latin translation of forensics. I think it means post-mortem. So it's after the event. So it's really recreating what happened on a system, and traditionally computers, but other systems now, Internet of Things devices, mobile phones, printers even, what happened and when it happened and what were the result? Yeah, you know, what's the results of that analysis? And then that's submitted as evidence in a civil, criminal, government investigation.
Okay. And from that, what part of that, I guess I want another definition, where does eDiscovery fit? So define and fit it in for me.
So eDiscovery is sort of forensics, computer forensics, and the processes that have been developed on collecting data and validating the collection and validating the processes. As I explained earlier, when we, if you follow the processes that are in place and you have the right training and the right processes in place, you can testify to this scientifically. Computer forensics has become the foundation of eDiscovery. So, and really from a processes point of view, if you go through the same process, you'll get the same results. If you gave this data to somebody else and they did the same thing, they would get the same results. And that's where computer forensics comes into it, because it allows you to validate what you've done in an eDiscovery process. And that could be from collecting data to processing it, to searching it, to doing deduplication, date range filtering, and a variety of ways of narrowing data sets that have to be resulting in data that has to be reviewed for relevance. And the goal with eDiscovery is to get that to be as small amount as possible. And so the forensic processes that are in place that are well recognized and defined and accepted by the court systems, they are the foundation of the eDiscovery process.
Okay, we're going to take our first break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You can find information about RICO's program at RICO-USA.com, and we'll return right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. I'm here today with David Greatham. David is the Vice President for the eDiscovery activities at RICO. And David, again, during the 9:30 Gov presentation you did yesterday, you recreated the digital touch points that you did on a trip, and I would like you to recreate that for our listeners here, because I really want them to get an idea of how many touch points are created every time they go online.
Absolutely. Well, I think if I remember, we talked about a trip to Chicago that I took in August. And I go into my hotel when I arrived in Chicago, and I picked up my cell phone and I noticed something that showed I'd created a data point. So that got me to thinking, okay, how many data points did I create on my journey? So I left my home in Houston. Just before I left, I have an Amazon Echo, and I checked that for the weather in the area to make sure I had the right clothing. I got a notification on my mobile device that my dry cleaning was ready to pick up, so I picked it up at the airport. Of course, I checked in online. And these days, you can check in at the hotel before you arrive as well and pick your room, so I did that. Then I got on the drive to the airport. I remembered I went through the easy tag or the toll, you know, you have a pass for the toll roads. I realized I'd forgot to set my home alarm, so I set that for my mobile device while at traffic lights. Really bad habit of forgetting where I parked my car at the airport, so I use a smart parking app, which basically takes a picture and puts some GPS coordinates so you can find your car when you come back in late at night and you're a little tired. I went through TSA pre-check, I got into the airline club, I got my personal hotspot going to download some email. Realized I hadn't paid my credit card, which was coming up due while I was on my trip, so I paid that online. The airline sent me a notification I'd been upgraded, which was nice, so I reassigned my seat. I got on the plane with an electronic boarding pass on my phone. On the flight, I had Spotify, I had some music on there, and I listened to a bit of an audiobook. I got Wi-Fi on the flight, made a VPN connection, and actually went through some documents and saved on my cloud storage. And actually, I was there for a very short period of time, so I checked in for my return flight while I was on the flight there, which is a little odd. Did some emails, I landed, I got an Uber to the hotel, and then I went to my hotel room. And what got me thinking of all this is I stayed at a hotel that has Bluetooth locks. So I basically skipped reception, went straight to my room, pointed my phone to the door, used my app, and it unlocked the door. And I was kind of amazed by that. And I thought I should go back and see really how much data I created. And so I spent some time. So what we forensics do, forensics people do when they have time in a hotel. And I really went through everything that I'd done. And of all those things, where did I create a data point? And I found that every single action that I just explained to you created a data point. In fact, I calculated it's about 632 megabytes of data that I created in less than 6 hours. And to put that into perspective, that's the equivalent to around 300,000 pages of, if I'd printed the information out.
Good Lord.
Yes.
All right. So let's say you were a person who was under suspicion of something, and the other David Greetham was looking into this and needed to verify, you know, your movement that day. How do you go about this?
So it can be a complex process. The data is stored in many different places. Some of it is stored on a device that you would own, such as maybe your mobile phone and some of the apps on there. And a lot of it is stored in cloud storage from the app service provider, if you like. So the example with the Amazon Echo, who I fondly call Alexa, there is some information stored actually on my phone. If you have such a device and you go into the settings and you go into the history, you can actually hear the voice recordings and the commands that you've given. So I could go on now and I could find my please tell me the weather in Chicago, and it would actually have my voice and that recording. Of course, that stays there for a limited period of time, and really Amazon services would be where you get more of that information.
Okay. So pretty much anything you do on a device. So what if you attempted to do some of this on a, you know, one of the phones that you just go into the store and buy as a temporary device? I mean, obviously you're going to have to check into the airport somehow, but.
Right. And, you know, this what we've talked about here is outside of other normal security, such as physical cameras, the means to have identification to get through TSA or to get through the security and what have you. We've certainly tracked people who have used, I think, what's commonly known as burner phones, where you go and you buy it, you pay cash, but the transaction is still recorded. If you buy it from perhaps Walmart or wherever you buy it from, they have cameras at the checkouts. So there are definitely other sources of information that a good investigator can track that back in most cases. But even with that, you need some credentials to use some of these services. As you know, you'll find often when you download an app from the App Store, even if it's free, it's going to want to send you an email. And you have to validate your address. Even if that's a free email account, that information is recorded with the service provider. Your IP address is recorded with them. And that's usually the source of getting back to somebody who's trying to perform some illicit actions.
Good Lord. So give me some real world examples here. I mean, you had some newspaper headlines. So pick one or two of those and explain exactly where the e-discovery process fit in.
Yeah, from a connected devices point of view, a lot of the high profile things that have happened recently have been criminal. However, when you look at Deepwater Horizon, the unfortunate incident down in my neck of the woods, some tracking and some logging was done through smart devices, which really got to the information of where the problems were. And a lot of people suspected what the problems were. But when you look at electronic evidence and it can confirm that, that becomes scientifically valid evidence. And I think that's helped with a lot of the government inquiries and with civil litigation that's come from that. There is a plethora of high-profile cases right now. I can think of one where somebody's been charged with arson. Their house went on fire. They woke up in the middle of the night, according to them, and packed some really important papers in a suitcase. And somebody put a ladder to the window, and they climbed down the ladder in horrific times. But this person had a pacemaker, and the information that the pacemaker recorded was admitted as evidence, and it showed that there was no elevated heart rate until the person got onto the ladder. And I can tell you from my point of view, if I woke up in my bedroom and I knew the house was on fire, I think my heart rate would be pretty highly elevated.
It would pick up a bit.
I think it would. So that, we have a case right now where somebody has a pretty strong alibi in a case, but we can prove that their car was at the scene of the crime. Yeah, you're being tracked. There is a case in Bentonville, Arkansas, where somebody had been found that died in a hot tub after a drinking session at somebody's house, and it was ruled as an unfortunate accident. However, the smart water meter showed that during the periods of 11 p.m. to 3 a.m., that 40,000 gallons of water had been used, and typically 17 gallons would have been used during that time. And that led law enforcement to, you know, look, was this a crime scene? Was water used? Was 40,000 gallons of water used to clean up the crime scene? And that case is still ongoing, but that evidence has been admitted and obviously is very important in that case.
Okay, we're going to take a break. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'll be back with David right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here today with David Greatham of RICO USA. David runs the e-discovery sales and operation division of RICO, which is ramping up. I mean, you're already working with corporate, you're working with large legal firms, and you're coming into the government arena via FedRAMP, which we'll touch on in a little. But how has digital forensics impacted rules of evidence in general, and how has it been accepted, adopted?
That's a really interesting question. Processes for validation and authentication of evidence have been in place for 20 plus years, and I was fortunate to be involved in partly altering some of those back when I lived on the other side of the pond. And that's been great. Forensics has run by that. Now with new data sources, that's changing. I think in 2008, we saw the introduction of remote imaging, because we're such a geographically dispersed country, and we have people who are remote workers now, and some people have requirements to collect data from outside of North America. Remote imaging, a lot of people said, how's this going to work? You know, we've got these standards in place. And remote imaging really emulated those standards, and so that's now being accepted and being universally used for about 10 years now, 9 or 10 years. And truthfully, in civil litigation, is the most common way of collecting data. But now we have these new data sources. You look at social media, you look at some of the things we talked about, how you track the Internet of Things. One of the core foundations of computer forensics collections was, how do you validate that what you have collected is the same of the source? And that was always done by hash values. That was, a hash value is essentially a digital fingerprint of a piece of data. It could be a piece of media like a hard drive or an iPhone, or it could just be a folder on a server. But you'd create a hash value which is more unique than a human fingerprint and has been universally recognized by the court systems for more than 20 years as, yes, this is the same as the data I collected. That's changing because now data is volatile. If you go try to collect somebody's Facebook, by example, it'll change during the collection. So not only will the hash values change during the collection, the data that you collected will have a different hash value. So there's been some challenges with that, and the federal rules of evidence have really been amended, and there's an amendment coming out on 1st December 2017, which partially addressed this. And, you know, we have some future challenges with the Internet of Things, with new devices. It's predicted that we're going to have 50 billion connected devices by the year 2020. And most of them you can't validate by comparing hash values. So some challenges ahead there.
And yesterday, or the when you were at the 930 Gov, you indicated that you thought that 50 billion devices was somewhat conservative because it's really hard to predict, you know, what's going to come out next that's got some sort of device in it.
That's right. And I think the 50 billion is projected on things staying the same as they are now. And of course, we know they're not. I think today the estimates are 21 billion. And, you know, there's things that we haven't been invented yet that will connect and will be connected. And I think the 50 billion number is a little low.
Well, you mentioned yesterday an embedded device in a shoe.
That's right.
Last week, rather.
A friend of mine shared a funny story when he bought some shoes online, and it came with a little note saying that your shoe has an embedded chip which has an IP address, and it's really to help them improve their product by checking the wear and tear of the shoe. It so happens to also track where you go, where there's open IP collectors, so it picks up your shopping habits, and I dare say you're going to receive some promotional marketing material in relation to where you go shopping, of course, because the manufacturers have your email address because you ordered this online.
So don't wear it if you're going to rob a bank.
That's probably good advice.
Yeah. So beware where you buy your shoes. So, I mean, you know, there's so much data out there. And the federal government is required by various laws around the National Archives, in particular, for records management and retention. So, how on the federal side alone, how do you store all this stuff, and then how do you make it retrievable? And where does digital forensics come into that?
Yeah, I think we've seen history has shown us that not everything has been retrievable that should have been. I think where forensics can help with that is introducing the process and validating the process. Like anything else, when you have something in place, it should be thoroughly audited. It should be tested. There should be disaster recovery options in place. And certainly forensic processes and the validation of that can be very helpful in that area.
Okay. But, you know, let's take a little deeper dive here. FedRAMP requires that everything that's going to be cloud-based be certified through, seems to be an evolving process. And RICO is involved in that. Why, where are you in the process, and what are you going to bring to the table here?
Well, we're about 2 weeks away from being FedRAMP ready. We've been working on this for 15 or 16 months now, and you're right, it has been an evolving process. And when we're finished with this in a couple of weeks, it looks very different from how it was when we started it 15 months ago. Some of the regulations have changed. Some of the guidelines have changed. So we've gone through our final audit now. And then we'll hopefully obtain a government sponsor and go from the FedRAMP ready stage to the FedRAMP certified. And I think the goal for this is we understand the cloud technologies have a lot of advantages for scalability, for disaster recovery. In this modern world that we have with all this data, we really need to embrace these services to continue functioning in our business and our government entity. The FedRAMP regulations wrap a lot of security around that, and that's obviously needed with some of the highly sensitive data that's been being stored in a cloud environment. Our goal is to enable government organizations to store and review documents and archive documents that are involved in litigious matters. I'll give you an example. If a government entity makes a document request of an organization, they may get hundreds of millions of documents presented to them. What do they do with that? Yeah, how do they review that? So we have some technologies. We use KQRO's Relativity, by example, for which is a proper legal document review tool that will allow the government entities to actually use that and the features of that in a FedRAMP environment. And I believe we're going to be the first to have achieved that. It's quite a process to go through, as you can imagine. And we've stuck the course, and we're almost at the finish line.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and take our last break here. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio. My guest is David Greatham of RICO. He is the Vice President of eDiscovery Sales and Operations for RICO. And again, you can find information about that at RICO-USA.com. Back after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. I'm here today with David Greatham of RICO. David is the Vice President of the eDiscovery Sales and Operations Unit. By the way, I've had the opportunity to talk to some of your folks. You're all over the country.
Yeah, we have representation throughout the United States and in Canada. And at the end of this year, we're going to be opening, although Rico are already around the world, we're going to be offering similar services in Europe.
Okay. So for us, the 902 changes, why did the changes occur and where are they going to take us?
So it's interesting that I've sat many a times around a courthouse waiting to testify. And if you're in a federal court, you can't have your beloved mobile device or your laptop with you. And I've sat there for days waiting to testify, and sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. And that's a pretty expensive process for a client to pay. I think the main changes of 902 are geared around allowing authentication of evidence to be done by affidavit or to be done by some other form of certification from a qualified person. And, you know, I think the computer forensics industry really welcomed that. For somebody to sit for 3 days to say, yes, I did this and yes, I did that, and that's my paperwork, and leave, and then the client has a hefty invoice at the end of it, nobody wants that. So I think that was the main purpose of the change. It can now be done by certification, whether it's an affidavit or some other type of certification, by a qualified person. You still need the person with the right expertise and the right documentation to do it. But another change, which really plays into some of the things we've already talked about and some of the challenges with all these new disparate data sources where we can't necessarily match hash values. One of the changes, I'll quote from it, it's 902.14, and the Advisory Committee on Evidence noted that the rule is flexible enough to allow certification through processes other than comparison of hash values, including by other reliable means of identification provided by future technology. And so it's really laying the foundation for not only some of these new things that we have now that we can't match the hash values for, but we don't have to change these rules every 2 years. So this is going to allow for somebody to be able to certify for future technologies we don't know about yet.
Okay. So, and if I didn't make this clear before, 902 is part of the federal rules of evidence. So, but there's going to be all of these challenges emerging that we can't even envision, really. Give me an idea of what you guys are doing to stay ahead of what digital forensics is doing in general to stay ahead, or RICO in particular, either way.
So I can tell you what we're doing, and I would imagine the rest of the computer forensics industries are doing something similar, is, you know, we're really focusing on best practices. And we're helping create certifications in relation to 902.13 and 14 at the source. So by example, if we collect some data and we process it and we run some searches and we look at exceptions and it goes into a document review and somebody from the government uses our FedRAMP environment and reviews documents in relativity and make decisions on whether it's relevant or whether it's not relevant or confidential and so on, that we'll create some automated reports for that, which will really comply with the authentication rules or the revised amended authentication rules with 902. So we're just proactively going out there and providing this documentation to our client base, whether asking for it or not, frankly. And I think that's good for them to look at it. I think one of the challenges we often see is that not all data can always be processed without extra touches. And I'll give you a couple of examples. You may have a PDF file that came from a scanner and it's not text readable. So you might have to OCR that. It might need some extra attention. You may have an Excel document that is password protected. And if it's password protected, the text and the content can't be put into a database for searching. And if you're doing a financial fraud investigation, you think an Excel password protected file might be quite important. So, or potentially important. So we make sure that the clients are aware of that so that they can say, hey, there are files here that are potentially relevant. Another example is if there's an investigation into a small business, you know, QuickBooks backups, they can't just be automatically processed. They have to have some expertise and a touch to extract the data to allow it to be searched. So we're proactively giving reports about these kind of things, exception handling, but and also for Rule 902, making sure that all the certification that somebody might need if they have to introduce this as evidence in a legal arena, that they already have that. So they don't have to come asking the day before and people are scrambling to get together. So things like that, we're really making some proactive steps to help our clients maximize the amendments to 902.
Okay. But there's been a lot of challenges in the data privacy arena in Europe, and especially data collection by large service providers, let's leave them unnamed, have garnered some attention in some court cases and in some instances some penalties or eliminating the collection of certain types of data. Where does all this play in, and where's privacy fit in general here?
Yeah, that's a really topical subject right now. With laws changing in Europe, I've watched some cases in Europe where you couldn't move data from Antwerp to Brussels, which is about 25 miles away in the same country. So the laws can get very granular in regions. New regulations are being introduced early next year, but privacy is a big concern. And I think we're going to see more privacy concerns in the US and North America, where people use their computers at work to do personal stuff. And it raises questions on who has ownership of that. And right now, I think it's being done by certain types of filtering so that you filter out anything personal. But it certainly is a challenge, and I think I'd encourage people to really become aware of that. And you take that a step further, what about the privacy of your actions? When I described my trip to Chicago, who owns that data? And I was working on that journey. Did my company own that data? They own my mobile device. Is my easy tag password on my commands that I give to Alexa open to my company if they had a litigation? So there's certainly some challenges there. A lot of this is evolving. I suspect we're going to have some new rules around privacy and encryption, because of course people like to encrypt things and not all encryption is breakable, or as a time and effort assessment there. So I think we got some future challenges ahead with that for sure, and that's the kind of thing that keep computer forensics professionals awake at night,
I would imagine. So let me throw a scenario out to you. So you're on an easy pass highway and you enter at point A and you exit at point B, but you do so in, let's call it, an expeditious manner. So even without a radar device, do you think somewhere down the road that highway system may issue you a ticket because your average speed would have been 15 miles over the limit?
That's a great question. I can give you some semi-personal experience here. I was with a friend of mine, and we were driving on the Florida Turnpike. And as you entered, you took a ticket. And as you exited, you went to the counter and gave them the ticket, and they charged you the appropriate amount. And we went about 200 miles on the Florida Turnpike. And about 3 weeks later, he got a speeding ticket in the mail because his average speed was 7 miles above the speed limit.
Seven.
Wow.
And
you got a ticket.
So they're already doing it.
This was a couple of years ago.
When that happens.
This was a couple of years ago. You'd think we talked about this already, but that's really interesting. The Florida Turnpike, they track the distance you traveled. I would encourage you not to drive too expeditiously and stop at a service station along the way and get some coffee.
Yeah. Take a rest stop, get a burger.
Right.
Give me some final thoughts here. I mean, this is an intriguing subject. It's a growing subject. I don't think you can predict the future, but if you can, try.
So, if we look back at what's happened in the last 20, 25 years, all of that has been very good, and the processes have been great and been well used, from performing investigations on computer systems to looking at the post-mortem side of what's happened. Really massive strides there. But I think we have to embrace change now. There's a big change coming, not just from collections and how we collect data and the hash value comparisons, but the types of data. We're going to see a lot more specializations, not just within the computer forensics arena. Perhaps somebody says, well, I'm a specialized in the Internet of Things. But there may be thousands of different specialities in the Internet of Things. There may be people who specialize in the systems inside cars. There may be people who specialize in artificial intelligence things that Google and Amazon offer. I think we're going to see that, and I think I'd encourage people to ask better questions and investigate a little bit more before they throw out blanket requests, because some of those requests will just simply not be able to be complied with. The interesting thing is, if you perform an investigation, there is a lot more data points that can help you get to the truth and get to the facts, which is, I think, the goal for everybody. It's just learning more about it, learning what to ask for. And I think we're going to see requests for collections be different. I think we'll see a lot more specializations. Certainly encryption and privacy are things that we're going to have to, and we are addressing and doing research and development with right now. And we have teams working on that. But they're future challenges for sure. And it's a changing world. We're creating so much data just by living our lives. So how do we encompass, how do we get around all this data? You know, federal rules were amended last year to introduce more proportionality, and that's certainly helping, but we're creating more data than ever before. I think IBM had a famous quote last year that of all the data in the world that we've ever had, that we have now, of all data of all time, that over 90% of it is new in the last 2 years.
Good Lord.
And that's a lot of data.
Probably 90% will be new in the next 2 months.
Right, and it's growing. It's growing. And data has a lot of value, right? So we've talked about the legal arena and maybe litigation or government demands, but it also has business commercial value. You can take your data and use it to do trend analysis, to look at what worked and what didn't work, and use that from a commercial advantage. So I think getting our arms around all this data, how you manage it, what intelligence you can take from it, that's happening now and certainly will happen in the future as well.
Well, the records management, the FOIA process, fraud, waste, and abuse just on the government side could save time, money, and provide information in a usable format faster, and that's where you guys are going.
That's right. We've been working on some FOIA requests now for on the West Coast, and we have some technology in place that's really helping them respond to that in a timely manner. But it's really just not timely and charging the right amount. It's how do you actually get to the information when there's so much of it? These are technologies that are available now that can certainly help government bodies comply with FOIA requests.
Cool. David, thank you so much for joining me. David Greatham, RICO-USA.com. This is not my day job. If you need any assistance in your marketing efforts targeting the federal government, or if you would like to pick up some skills on social selling, particularly through LinkedIn, drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you for listening to AmTower Off Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.